I would like you all to give a warm welcome to our main speaker, Red.
Hi, everybody. My name is Red Aldridge, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome the birthday people and the chip takers. There's no way in the world that I'd ever try to stand up here and tell anybody in this room whether they're alcoholic or not. I don't believe I'm qualified to do that. However, if you happen to start identifying with some of these innermost feelings I'm going to try to describe, some of these symptoms, this terminal disease that I have, I would sure as hell pay attention. I didn't do any drinking at an early age. I had an obsession. I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly the fastest airplanes ever built. I had a real drawback. I was born back in what they called the Depression years. I know a lot of you aren't even old enough to remember them. From the sound of those speakers, they might be having a little touch of them right now and then. I knew my chances weren't going to be that great. I started investigating. It seemed to be the only chance that to be the military, except back in those days we didn't have an Air Force, per se. Part of what was called the old Army Air Corps. I found to get into it, I was going to have 2 years of college and a senatorial appointment. I knew the money wasn't going to be there for that college education due to the times. I was no great student, but I was a big kid. I figured I could do it athletically. I stayed clean all the way through high school. I was out for football and basketball. I won my football scholarship at Colorado State University. I wangled my 2 years of college that way, got my senatorial appointment, and they sent me to Randolph Field, which was the old Army Air Corps Academy. It kept me real busy for the rest of my training, and through that period of my life, booze was no problem. I just didn't use it. I graduated as a second lieutenant back in the old Army Air Corps, just prior to us getting into World War II. I see a few guys sitting out there tonight can probably remember how unprepared we were for that hassle. Our dads were supposed to fight one to end them all, and Congress had never seen too fit to approach the kind of a show we've got today. We got tossed into that North African campaign over there against a bunch of guys who had been sitting there practicing for a couple of years, and they got real good at what they were doing. We were strictly under-trained and for sure under-airplane. I found myself in a situation on that first tour. A lot of times we were putting up 25 against 200, and we were getting the hell kicked out of us. I came back off of one of those raids very early in that first tour of duty, and that particular day we only got 8 back out of the 25. Now, I think a lot of you can identify with adrenaline, Mother Nature's drug, usually triggered by fear. Fear of death, fear of failure, fear of the unknown. You get a near miss out here on the freeway, you handle it real good. You get a half mile down the road, you can't keep your foot on the accelerator. That's adrenaline. I'd been hooked on adrenaline since I was a little kid. I loved it. Some people back off from fear. I always like to attack it. I loved that rush, and I'd been hooked on it for a long, long time. That particular day, I'd had nothing but 6 hours of adrenaline. I was standing in an interrogation line waiting to go in to talk to him about what had happened. And old Red was shaking. I was shaking in every bone in my body. Now, I wasn't too worried about adrenaline shakes. I'd had them a lot of times before. You stand there and wait for that football to come down to that 250-pound lineman about to nail you, and you'll quiver. I don't give a damn who you are. But you get in the game, and you get over it, and I knew I'd get over it. This flight surgeon standing there looking at me wasn't that sure. He says, "What's the matter, Red?" I said, "Nothing. I'll be all right." He looked at me for a few minutes. He says, "Young man, I got just what you need." I had never paid any attention to that medicinal table that they had set up there in operations, but on it, they had about a half a dozen open fifths of what they call medicinal whiskey. Think about that for a few minutes. Whiskey is a medicine. Reached over and picked up a water glass, and he poured me about 2 fingers, and he said, "Here, drink this." And I looked at him and said, "I really don't want it." He looked me right in the eye, and he says, "Young man, I prescribe it." Man, I hung on to that for the next 20 years. I picked that thing up, turned it up, drank it, walked on into interrogation, and if you've got an alcoholic personality like I have, I think you know what happened. Man, that stuff sat there and flowed out there to those fingertips and out there to those toes, and all of a sudden, I'm sitting there real comfortable. I looked down and I roped. You know, 10 minutes before, I hadn't been able to light a cigarette or pick up a cup of coffee. 10 minutes down the line, half a glass of booze in them, I'm looking at them and they're frozen, just like they are tonight. And literally, old Red never shook at anything again for the next 20 years. I thought I had found the elixir of life. I really believed it. And booze worked that well for me for a long, long time. Even after it started doing to me, it would still do for me. I soon found to get the full benefit out of it, I had to keep recreating the kind of situation I'd had that first day. Probably combat's the best adrenaline builder I ever found before or since. I became a combat freak. I stayed 3 years and 2 tours of duty, and I got good at what I was doing. I learned to live on that knife's edge, that fast lane. Booze was always there at the end of the day to handle anything that I couldn't. God, I'd come in at night, see guys sitting on the edge of their beds, worried about going the next day. You know, and I'd look at them and think, geez, I wish they could find alcohol. It never dawned on me that it worked so much better for me than it did for them. I went right on through World War II. I was back here in the States. I probably should have been able to lay that medication down and go on about my business. But in retrospect, I think I started running into one of the first symptoms of this disease. Some of you might identify with it. It's called justification. Rather than laying it down, I went looking for a job that had some adrenaline. Most of the real good airplanes, the jet-type airplanes that we've got today, were just coming off the drawing boards. They were looking for guys that had a lot of combat experience to evaluate them. I put my application in and got accepted as a test pilot to the Proving Ground Command. Hell, the excitement was back. I was flying the kind of airplanes now that I laid on those Colorado hillsides and dreamt about when I was a kid. I was flying with the best. I knew it. Booze was still working for me. In fact, I think it probably started working just a little bit too well. Proving Ground Command is Eglin Field in Florida. In fact, it still is. They got a big officers club built right out there in the Gulf there, Fort Walton. I used to catch myself an awful lot of nights hanging out at that club until 1 o'clock in the morning, just kind of tranquilizing the day. And I know I had a 6:30 test off. Not always for sure. But every once in a while, I'd wake up in that BOQ at around 10 o'clock in the morning with that cold sweat start we come to in. I'd look at my watch and say, didn't I or didn't I? You know, you pick up the phone, call the sergeant and say, did everything written up they wanted this morning? Yes, sir, right down the line. You walk back down to the line, step up on the wing of that bird, and the knee pad is yours. The checkoffs are yours. Signature is yours. Geolometer says you've been up to speed of sound, and the only thing you can't recall is going. Don't kid me, it hasn't happened to you. You step out there on that porch in the morning, that car sitting in the driveway, you say, how did you get home last night? Another symptom of this disease, it's called blackout. The overuse and abuse of the mind-altering drug alcohol to the point that it blacks out the conscious mind. If you got any coordination at all, you're going to get by with a mile of it. Hell, I've seen guys go for a week in a blackout. You'd never see them stagger. If they had no conception of where they were or what they were doing. It should just scare the living hell out of an alcoholic, and I don't believe I've ever met one that it bothered too much. We write her off the idea that, God, I must have had a good time last night. In the occupation that I was in, I knew it wasn't what I was looking for. I started my first feeble attempts at control. I'd always been a binge drinker at the end of the day. I figured if I was going to exercise control at all, I had to string it out over a longer period of time. And I think this is how an awful lot of us become daily drinkers. I gave up binge-type drinking, but I didn't give up drinking. I just strung it out over a longer period, and it worked great for a lot of years. Most of the real good airplanes I'd really wanted to test were off the drawing board by this time anyway. I was looking for something that had a little more kick to it, and as usual, the Air Force come up with it. We found out we'd let way too many guys out after World War II. They started a big recruiting campaign to get the key personnel to come back. One of the promotional aspects they come up with was the organization of what's still known today as the Air Force Demonstration Team. Probably most of you have seen that team at one air show or another around the country. You don't get sentenced to that team, you volunteer for it. I had all the qualifications. I put my application in and got accepted. It's not all fun and games, for sure. You practice at that stuff 4.5 days a week. At that time, we were flying 32 air shows around the country a year. They're up to 48 now. They only let you do it for 2 years, and it's probably enough because it's an adrenaline-building son of a gun. But I was back flying with the best again, and I knew it. Booze was still working for me. I think I started running into another symptom about this time. Some of you might identify with it. It's called hangover. God, I have never found, and this is before or since, a worse place to shake a hangover than an aerobatic formation. You just think about it for a few minutes. You walk out there in the morning, that canopy comes down over you, and you're trapped. You know, there's no way in the world you're going to stop at a corner tavern, that's for damn sure. You hook that oxygen mask across your face and you can no longer become ill. You pull into that 18-inch interval formation and those guys just insist that you don't shake. You do a lot, maybe you might identify with this, and it's called the deep sweats. You know, God, I used to sit there and wonder how come. How come something that's worked for me so long, so well, is kicking me around like this? I used to try to analyze it. I'm thinking, hell, maybe it's the life you lead, Rip. Maybe at the end of your 2 years, if you'd resign, get out, get the civilian life, get a business going, get a family started. Do the things I'd seen my buddies do, that I could get a handle on this drinking. I always believed right up until I had both feet through the gates of insanity and death that given the right set of circumstances, I could control my drink. I think this philosophy of self-sufficiency that we all grow up with, where every guy and every gal should be an island to themselves, is probably what helps about 14 to 16 million of those practicing alkies that are out there tonight self-medicate themselves right out of this world, whatever finding what we find in rooms like this, that there is a way out. I finished my 2 years. I resigned. I hit civilian life. All my buddies had been out there about 6 years ahead of me, 5.5 to 6. They'd got out right after World War II. They'd gone back to school and completed their educations. They had positions, homes built, families started. If you're anything in it like I am as an alcoholic, you know what you're going to do. Double up and catch up. This is the way I hit civilian life. I went into business. I built a tri-level home. I got married. I started that family. The business I went into was immediately successful. I'd grown up in it, and I've been in it most of my sober years. You guys contributed an awful lot to it in your drinking careers. It's called the auto body business. But it was good. I got to be all right if I'd have just worked at it 8 hours a day, but I was working 12 and 14 and 16 hours a day. I went 6 days a week. Then I put on 2 shifts. I got that tri-level home down there paid for in a short period of time. I got a trust fund started for the kids to get them through college, and hell, they're only 1 in 3. This is the way we think, and this is the way we drive, and I'd come through those doors at night, so damn beat I could hardly hold my head up. Flop in that easy chair, and there was one thing I could always sell right on. Man, if there's anything you've earned yourself today, you know what it was, a drink of booze, and I was no better off than I was sweating hangovers at 30,000. A strange thing happened to me about this time in my life. Oh, Harry Truman got his foot in his mouth and sicked us on Korea. I was telling you, we hadn't trained any fighter pilots after World War II. He found it out in a hurry. He had to call the war worries. God, just 21 days from the day I was recalled, I looked out there, I got 2 500-pound napalms nailed each wing again. They're saying, sick 'em, Tiger. They just went that way. I got another 100 missions to do. You know, I'm 30 years old by this time. Maybe they don't sound old, but it's getting old for a fighter pilot. Especially one with a progressive disease. Now, I had no idea that I had a progressive disease. Hell, I was still passing Class A physicals every 6 months. How could I have a disease? When I started to do that new 100 in Korea, something became quite evident to old Red in a hurry. Those damn missions had got too long between drinks. You know, I told you I'd been a daily drinker now for an awful long time. I think these chains of alcoholism lie so lightly on our shoulders that a lot of us have no idea that they're there until we're just completely enmeshed. Till all of a sudden we wake up one morning to the fact that we are no longer telling alcohol when we're going to drink it. Booze is beginning to tell us when we're going to drink it. I solved that situation very simply. I went over to the PX and I bought myself 2 8-ounce flasks. One for each winter flight boot. And hell, it worked great. I'd use the right one going out and the left one coming home. A long time after booze started doing to me, it would still do for me. I think it brought out very vividly just how hooked I was really getting. Along about my 40th mission, I got shot up again for about the umpteenth time in my life. And a shell come through the bottom of the airplane that morning right through my left leg, and it kicked it clear into my chin. You know, I still remember getting my foot back down on that rudder, and I could feel liquid running into that left winter flight boot. I still remember sticking my hand down there and pulling her back and thinking, hot dog, it's blood. Only alcoholics identify with it. I still had 30 minutes to make it home, and I was damn glad to have my medication still intact. I finished my 100. I got back here to the States. I got to think, you know, maybe, Red, you could find yourself a flying job far enough away from booze. Maybe even get someplace where it's not so readily available. As usual, the Air Force took care of it. We were just starting to build the radar sites up across the Arctic Circle. I went north, and if any of you are thinking about that, my God, forget it. I spent a year in Thule, Greenland, where the warmest day we had was 23 below. So cold weather will not do it. It just won't do it. I finally volunteered to come on back down to Harmon, that big Seagram's distillery there in Newfoundland, to pick up the monthly ration of booze for that base up there. Thule's only about 450 miles from the North Pole. I brought down a twin-engine airplane that afternoon. I loaded her clear down with those big 40-ounce Canadian jugs of that CC and VO. I started back up there that night, and I got into one of the damnedest Arctic storms I was ever in, and I lost an engine. And one of those nights I called Air Sea Rescue, and those bastards wouldn't even come out. You know, I fought that thing all night, and I got into Thule just at Arctic dawn, and the whole base was down there to meet me. I got to thinking, isn't it great they're that worried about old Red? I rolled back that window, and the first thing they asked me is, you didn't salvo that load, did you? It had never even crossed my mind. I don't know if you guys had this problem or not. As a daily drinker, I was developing a hell of a smell problem. You know, when you drink booze all day like I did, you begin to smell like booze all day. I got to think, you know, maybe if you'd get back to Europe, Red, where they got that wine on the table and they eat a lot of garlic, that at least you'd blend in better. I volunteered for Fleet Line Service, which is the airline that resupplies NATO. God, I went back over. My northern run was Brussels, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm. Now, those are progressive disease towns, I'll guarantee you. I was picking up a lot of rank over the years. They kept trying to trap me for command. They got it done. They jerked me back here to the States, sent me through staff and command school, gave me an air defense group, and stuck me up here at Hamilton just outside of San Francisco. God, now I got 800 men in my command. You know, I'd hear my airplanes roll every morning. It seemed like invariably I'd look out there at that outer office of mine. That adjutant would always have about a half a dozen of my boys sitting out there waiting for me to talk to. I found an awful lot of mornings taken up counseling. These kids had been in town getting themselves into all kind of trouble, most of it drinking. I had a system. I had an eyes-on safe alongside of my desk, and he used to keep a 40-ounce jug of Smirnoff Red Vodka in there with a hooked glass straw. Every time he'd go out to get one of those boys, I'd hit the safe, and usually by noon, I was giving some pretty damn good lectures. Also knew I was going to get in one hell of a lot of trouble sooner or later. Air Force had always been awful good to me all my life. I sure as hell didn't want to mess them up any more than I was doing it presently. Yeah. Again, I decided to resign. This time it didn't work. My resignation got as far as Air Defense Command at Colorado Springs. They reviewed it and bounced it. They bounced it with a recommendation that I be sent to Parks, 3-month psychoanalysis. They thought I was suffering from delayed combat fatigue. Hell, I couldn't very well then go and tell them what I was suffering from. If I had any other terminal disease in this world, I'd have been in there on that doctor's doorstep every morning, laying the symptoms on them. Yet you can drag that dying alcoholic into that same doctor's office, reading that same set of questions when it comes to that one where it says, do you drink excessively? Oh, a couple of beers now in that doctor. Self-denial, the greatest symptom of all the symptoms I've been trying to describe. Our complete lack of our innermost selves to get honest enough to admit that alcohol is just taking us to pieces. I had to spend 3 months on that ward. This was a long time ago, and it was the first help that was probably ever offered to me as an alcoholic. I don't believe that psychiatry could possibly help the practicing alcoholic due to the self-honesty bit. I had to spend that 3 months on that ward. I had 3 appointments with those doctors a week for that 3-month period. I had open post as an officer. The club opened at 12 o'clock noon and it closed at 1. I used to open it every day at 12 and close it at 1. In that 3-month period, those guys never saw me that I wasn't bombed out of my mind. And yet there's not one mention in that whole medical report of the word alcoholism. You see, they didn't even realize it was a treatable disease at that time. They did let me out. Families long since got tired of my shenanigans and been on their way. My folks had moved out here to the West Coast, and they'd been real successful. I had a big home over there on top of Palo Verde Hills over there behind San Pedro. I figure I'll get over there in that big den with that boob tube and that beautiful view of Los Angeles Harbor. All the pressure of the couple of wars that I've been fighting through are off my back. I'm going to get a handle on this drinking. I lasted about 2 weeks up there, and I was going out of my gourd. It was one of those big wooden globes, one of those Columbus-type globes sitting in that den. I kept looking at that thing and thinking, you know, maybe, Red, you've never taken a true geographic. I'd always been around guys that could cover for me, guys that had gone to combat with or school with. I figured if I'd get someplace in this world far enough away from anybody that knew me that I'd have to do it on my own. I run my finger up over the meridian to see what was on the other side of the world from Palo Verde. If you want to try it, it's Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. I knew that TWA hired for those guys, and I knew the personnel manager of TWA real well. I called him up and said, I'm looking for a job, and 1 month later, I was flying captain on Ethiopian Airlines. Halfway around the world again. Nobody knows Red. All he knows is he's got lots of flying time. He's qualified. I gave it my best shot. I don't know whether you guys tried white-knuckle sobriety or not, but I stayed sober a year on guts. And if you're thinking about it, my God, forget it. It was the most miserable year I ever spent in my life, before or since. There wasn't a waking moment that I didn't want to drink. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and have to go down to the kitchen, pour myself one, set it on the table, and sweat it. Not drink it. Prove yourself you got guts enough. I'd go to a movie, and I'd have to get up in the middle of it and go to the bar and have the bartender pour me one. Not drink it. Sit there and sweat it. That's the way I went through the year. At the end of it, I figured, well, there's one thing you proved, Tiger. At least you're not an alcoholic. And I went out to celebrate. It was my last fight. I don't remember ever fighting after that. You come up that hill, so gradually hit that level off period, and you finally get over on the backside of that alcoholic curve. I'll guarantee you, once you're on the backside of that curve, you're going to start donating to the pot to reserve your right to use this drug. Usually jobs, securities, homes, things that we worked hard for most of our lives, you're going to find yourself tossing them into the pot to reserve your right to use this drug. Families, loved ones, people that have stuck by us through hell and high water, all of a sudden we're tossing them into the pot to reserve our right to use this drug. You want to hang out there as long as Red did, you're going to get things like integrity, self-respect, anything that means anything to you on the backside of that curve. If you want to hang out, you've got to donate. I used to look down and say, if I ever got like that joker, I would quit. Pretty soon I'd be just like him, and I'd say, I mean that one, down there. Down that hill I went. It wasn't too many years before they quit renewing my airline contracts. Africa, about this time, most of those colonial powers were going independent. I found it was a hell of a demand for the kind of flying I'd been doing most of my life. All of a sudden, I find old Red shooting at people for money. You know, this has a funny effect on your insides. I'd always had principles to fight for through a couple of wars. I'm just sitting out there shooting a guy to support a habit that I don't seem to be able to do anything about. A lot of other pressures can be put on practicing alcoholics, as all of you know. I told you I'd been CO of an air defense group that helped build a radar site. I had a top secret clearance all my military career. Now I'm flying for a foreign government. You hear things like OSI and CIA, you don't think too much about it, but I can guarantee you they're out there. They can give a practicing alky fits. They know who's paying it and how much. They know where you're banking it, opening your mail. Maintenance isn't worth a damn. You've been shot down in that part of the world. All these pressures are building. I'm doing the one thing that's always worked. I'm pumping that booze, and it got worse. It finally got so bad that they even quit hiring me for it. I ended up, and I'm sure as hell not proud of this, flying through mountain passes with my landing lights on railroad tracks for navigation. I'm a flight through low-level over water. My landing fields are deserted beaches and they're flashlight lit. I have a feeling you know what I'm doing. I'm smuggling because that's where the money is. That's where all the fears are, too. If I get caught doing what I'm doing now, they put me away for life. And yet alcohol took all those choices away. And if you want to hang out there as long as Red did and you live, that's exactly what it's going to do to you. I kept right on with that kind of a crappy existence until I finally got so bad they even hired me for it. Back here in the States, 41 years old, I guess I was about as unemployable as a guy can really get. I figured I had too many things I hadn't tried a couple times in this world. If I couldn't whip it, at least I could get with it. I bought myself 10 cases of those 40-ounce jugs of that Smirnoff Red vodka. I stuck them in that hillside over there in Palo Verde. And I went on, supposed to be old Red's last drunk. This was 31 years ago. It was before detox or care centers or hospitals that have anything to do with an alcoholic. People on the side of that hill had no idea what was wrong with me. I'd been out there on my own since I was 18. They'd really never been around me, though. They knew I was getting awful sick physically. That drunk lasted 64 days. The last 30 of it I hadn't eaten. My normal weight's 220. I was down to 138 pounds of emaciation, and most of that was liver. I think God stepped into my life at this time. Those people picked a doctor out of the phone book to see if he'd make a house call. And you know that doctor actually made that house call. I know today that he didn't do it because of his Hippocratic Oath. They happened to pick one that's a member of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. That doc was making a 12-step call, is what he was doing. He came out to that house and he told those people what I was up against. Said he'd seen some amazing recovery on a program that he himself was trying, that he was going to do what he could for me physically. He's going to leave some names for me to call him. I don't remember ever getting that well. He thought I was going to die, and they thought I was going to die. So I guess they just called you. My first recollection of you sober guys were those guys sitting on the edge of that bed. And you know, they literally nursed old Red back to health and started hauling me into rooms like this. And man, you new guys looked good tonight. I was a tongue-chewing, wet-brained, babbling idiot when they hauled me to the door. Thank God you read this portion of chapter 5 like they did tonight, because I think that's what saved Red's life. I wasn't capable of hearing too much. I could hear, just don't drink today, and then they'd read those 12 suggested steps. Setting that old maritime meeting over there in Wilmington one Saturday night, about 30 days sober, they had just read that portion of chapter 5, and it all come crashing in, what I'd been trying to identify with. See, for many years, drunk or sober, the only thing that had ever kept me alive in those complicated airplanes I'd been flying was called a checklist. A list in which everything I had to do to get through one flight was written down. And I'd never gone near a bird in my life, drunk or sober, that I hadn't used that checklist from the time I walked up until the time I walked away. It'd get me through just one flight. Sitting back there that night, all of a sudden it dawned on me what 24 hours really is. 24 hours, just one flight in life. And those 12 suggested steps of the checklist to keep you from ever having to go back out there and pick up that first drink of booze. I've been using that 12-step checklist on a daily basis now for the last 30 years. I've never found it necessary to go back out there and pick up another drink of alcohol, tranquilizing, sedating, elevating pill. Haven't had to smoke any funny grass. I've probably been as close to chemically free as a guy can stay in this modern world, and I owe it all to you guys. On my own, I'd given it my best shot. I'd never scratched the surface. Everything I've been talking about tonight, I've learned in rooms like this. You got your hand up tonight or recently, and you said, my name is, whatever it is, and I'm an alcoholic. You pretty well got that number one step nailed. That's what we're talking about. We admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable. And that's just about what you're able to do when you hit your feet in front of a bunch of your peers and say, my name is Red, and I'm an alcoholic. If you're anything like I was, though, and you hit that step number two, that thing will just jar the living hell out of you. There's a real inference in that step. I'm going to have to ask a fire greater than old Red to restore me to sanity. You know, before I can take that step, I got to admit I'm nuts. I got to admit I had to be. Where else would you find a guy completely allergic to a drug that if he continued to use it was going to kill him that went out there and pumped it down a couple of fifths a day? There's got to be all kind of insanity in us before we come through those doors. Don't let it shake you too much. I'm going to tell you my insanity story. For years, by the time I'd get my shop closed in Long Beach and get out to Buena Park and change clothes and then double back up to meetings that I had to speak at, I was always driving like a son of a gun, like I was tonight. This guy was doing the same thing. He was on the off-ramp about 10 minutes from the meeting. He thought he had it nailed. He hit the off-ramp, got about a half a block down the street and blew a tire. He jumped out and lug nuts off, put him in a hubcap behind him. Just setting his spare up, a car come whizzing along behind him, caught the edge of the hubcap and flipped all his lug nuts right out in the weeds. And he's frantic. He's out there beating these weeds to death, and it's dark, and he knows he's going to be late. All of a sudden, he heard a voice. Now, he hadn't paid any attention where he'd rolled to a stop. He looked up, and he was parked right in front of an institution for the alcoholically insane. One of the inmates had been sitting up there on a fence watching all this. He says, hey, mister. The guy says, I haven't got time to talk to you right now. He says, I'm in a hell of a hurry. Guy sitting up on a fence says, I've been sitting up here watching you. He says, I figured you must be. He says, hell, if I was in that big a hurry, he said, I'd take the other three hubcaps off, take a lug nut off of each wheel, put that thing on there and get going. He looked at him and says, oh, my God, that's the answer. He says, how did you come up with that? I thought you were insane. And the guy says, I am, but that's no sign I'm stupid. point I'm trying to make, guys, is this. All of us, when we come through those doors back there, are a wee bit bent out of shape. We've been out there kicking ourselves around for a hell of a long time. But the mere fact that we've come looking for help sure as hell proves that we're not stupid. This is where the answers are in rooms like this. Guys and gals sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other. We can solve this common problem. I hit that step number 3, and I think all of you know what happened. I run into that word God. I went running from my sponsor, and I said, Mac, is that the God they're talking about? He says, yeah, right. And I said, I haven't got a chance. I got 250,000 years in purgatory to do before I can even start this program. He said, you didn't read the small print, Red. And I said, what's that? He says, the God of your understanding. I knew I was going to have to turn my will over to a power greater than Red. And you know, all of a sudden it dawned on me that there was one right there in front of me. You guys. Group power. Man, I could believe in group power. I've been tucked up in groups all my life. As long as I was in the group, I had all the firepower in the world. The only one I was out there as a straggler, I was going to get my ass shot down. Started hanging with the winners, the guys that had some time on this program. I started listening to them. I started picking their brains. And they taught me. They taught me real good about this power that Dale Red calls God. My sobriety on a daily basis is a gift from you guys and God. What I do with that sobriety is my gift back to Him. He's let me become part of that pipeline of information started by that first 100 guys and a gal that wrote that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only way I can keep it is to keep giving it away. I got to be standing at that door when the new guy or the new gal comes in or up here at a podium. I got to share my experience, strength, and hope with them like they did with me when I come through that door. This is the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got down to the end of that checklist. It said having had a spiritual awakening. Nothing had happened. I got to go to a convention about my first 60 days. I heard an old boy from the podium, and he sounded spiritual. He sounded spiritual every time I ever heard him after that. He passed away down Laguna a few years back. A lot of you knew him, but I took him aside after that convention. I said, come on, Chuck, tell me about spiritual. He says, I'm glad you asked, Red. He said, I did a lot of research on it and come up with a definition. I said, that's what I'm looking for, something this alky brain can handle. He says, Red, spiritual is that which is not material. I started reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous real conscientiously to find out what that first 100 guys and the gal had in mind when they put that in her. The more I read it, the more I became convinced what they were talking about were my attitude and my emotions. These are the things that had always driven me back out there to pick up that first drink. Alcohol was merely a symptom of what was wrong with me. My attitude prior to finding you guys, when I'd step out there and take a look at a day, was, oh God, another day. And it had been that way for a long, long time. What you guys have taught me is to step out there and take a look at the day and say, thank God, another day. See, I've been granted one I shouldn't have had. The average age of death when I come through those doors was 41, and I was 41. I just barely snuck in. It means that every day that I've been granted over the last 30 years, a day at a time, is a gift from you guys and God. And you can't get too ungrateful for a situation like that. I get up to a podium like this, I get right up on cloud 9. I've got to tell you my attitude story. This guy walked into a barber shop not too long ago. He's right up on cloud 9. A barber got him in the chair, and he says, what are you so happy about? He says, I got a 747 reservation going to Rome. He says, I'm going over there and eat some of that good Italian food. I've even got an audience with the Pope. The barber looked at him and says, what's the matter with you, man? He says, that 747 is the roughest airplane in the sky. He says, you'd be air sick all the way over there. He says, you start eating that Italian food and Montezuma's revenge, you're going to seem mild. He says, you know the Pope isn't going to have time for a commoner like you. The guy had gone in there right on cloud 9. Now, he came out of the haircut right down in the pits, you know, right where those norms usually drop me. He didn't see him for 30 days, and all of a sudden, the guy come bounding back in again, and he's really out of sight this time. He got him back in the chair, and he says, what now? He says, I made the trip. He says, that 747, the smoothest airplane in the sky. He says, there wasn't a ripple going over. He said, I gained 10 pounds eating that Italian food. He says, the best I ever had. He said, I even got my audience with the Pope. I got to kneel at his feet, kiss his ring, and he says, would you believe he even had a question for me? The barber looked at him and says, what could he possibly ask you? He says, where did you get that lousy haircut? Don't let them tear you down. I can't guarantee you get your wives back, your husbands back, your kids back, your health back, your jobs back. But I can guarantee you that those 12 suggested steps are going to give you the tools to start digging into that pile of stuff you brought through the door. And if you'll use them as tools, I can also guarantee you're going to start to uncover in a hurry. Something that you can live with pretty comfortably for as long as you want to hang around this program a day at a time. I don't have too much trouble after 30 years turning my will and my life over to the care of God. But, you know, I still have an awful lot of trouble leaving it there. I don't know if you guys run into that or not. When it gets good, guess who likes to take the credit for it? I'm going to close a little incident that happened to me down at the shop just before I retired a couple years back. I got up one morning. I had a whole bunch of situations down there that morning. I really didn't want to go down and handle them. I'm still pretty good at procrastination. I haven't hauled around that house until I finally hit that 91 freeway going to Long Beach running late. Now, even to this day, when old Red hits a freeway running late, strange things begin to happen. People get cut out, horns get blown, fingers get given. You know, I'm building a head of steam and I haven't even got to work yet. Whenever I start to act that way, that old monster inside of me begins to lash. That one that used to whip me right over to that corner tavern. I got to run that checklist. Man, I hit that turn it over button and it's froze in a down position. I haven't turned anything over to God. I talk to him just like I'm talking to you guys. I said, okay, sir, I'll just go down and do the footwork. You handle it. I got down there that morning. None of those situations that I'd anticipated ever did come in. All the stuff that did come in was just like glass. It was a nice day. Now, I jumped in that same car that night, headed back out 91 on my way home. Guess who I'm patting on the back for the way I handled that situation? All of a sudden, it dawned on me I was taking credit where it wasn't due. I busted out laughing, and I looked over, and the guys driving on each side of me on the freeway are tuning radios, trying to find out what the hell I'm listening to. But it reminded me of a story that I used to use back in my combat days about credit, where credit's due. I had 6 clusters to my DFC, and when I'd wear them, guys would look at me, and they'd say, where in the hell did you ever get those, Red? And I used to have a stock answer that I got pushed in the pond. But the story goes like this. It's about a Texas rancher. He had one of the biggest spreads in Texas. Thousands of acres, big old Olympic-sized pool, a barbecue area, a rambling ranch house. Just as a conversation piece, he built himself about 150 yards across the alligator pond. Filled it with the meanest damn alligators he could find the world over. These big old 15-foot snappers, and he didn't feed them too good. All these guys got out there one afternoon drinking his booze and telling these war stories, and this Texan finally got a little tired of him. He says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, any of you guys really want to prove your courage? Anybody will go down there and swim across that alligator pond? He says, I'll give you my daughter's hand in marriage, $1 million or a ranch like mine. Figured he'd shut him up for good. He no more turned his back and he hears all this commotion. He turned around and here this guy is swimming out across that pond and he is moving out. He's leaving a rooster tail. He made it. A Texan run around helped him out. He says, I've never seen such a display of courage. He says, I'll stick with my bargain. He says, imagine you want my daughter's hand. Guy shook his head and he says, oh, no, sir. He says, I'm already married. He looked at him. He says, well, he says, then it's got to be $1 million. Guy shook his head and he says, no, sir. He says, I have an income for life. He looked at him and he says, well, then it's got to be the ranch like mine. The guy shook his head and he says, no, sir. He says, my daddy left me one in his will. He looked at him and he says, well, what do you want? He says, I want the name of that son of a bitch that pushed me in the pond. You've been a great audience, gang. Just remember, every guy and gal in this room tonight got pushed into that pond of alcohol. No human power could have ever got us out of there. God can and he will if he is sought. May you find him now. May that power watch over us all a day at a time through the eternity of our spiritual existence. I sure want to thank you guys.